This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of the news as we discuss the people, stories, and events affecting the tri-state. And joining me this afternoon are WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Education Reporter Bob Driehaus, Investigative Reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer James Pilcher, Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler, and WVXU Political Reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And James, Karen, Bob, and Howard, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Yes,
I'm happy to be here. Today.
Glad to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Howard, the funeral is today for former Ohio Governor and U.S. Right. Senator George Voinovich,
right.
And he died Sunday at the age of 79. What were his accomplishments from a political standpoint?
Well, they are many and of a long duration. I mean, I knew him first as Jim Rhodes' running mate in 1978 when he was running for lieutenant governor. He was a Cuyahoga County commissioner at the time. And they were elected, and he was bored to death being lieutenant governor. And the city of Cleveland, his home, his hometown, was in dire financial straits, defaulting on loans. They were near bankruptcy. It was a really a horrible mess. And he was convinced to go back and run for mayor, which he did. He ended up in a runoff with the previous mayor, Dennis Kucinich, and won. And there is no question about it. He worked with the business community, the banks, the people on city council, like George Forbes, the president of city council, and essentially saved the city and put it on a path to the kind of a really vibrant city that it is today. And obviously, then he served as governor of the state of Ohio for two terms. He was two terms in the United States Senate, but always, he would tell you, if you asked him, the thing he was most proud of was being mayor of city of Cleveland and what he was able to accomplish there.
Karen, can you make the argument that he was the most successful politician in Ohio?
Yeah, you can. I mean, he ran 30 races. He lost two of them.
Yep.
That's pretty impressive. And one was a primary in 1971, and the other was the 1998 U.S. Senate race against Howard Metzenbaum.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the only two races he lost. And, you know, coming out of the 88 race, which was, from what I've been able to read, terribly managed and really was not a well-done Senate campaign, he came back in 1990 and won against Attorney General Anthony Celebrezze Jr., the Democrat who was running for governor. And apparently it was, you know, a lot of people consider it a very, very well-run campaign. He went on in 1994 to be reelected governor by the largest percentage of any person ever in Ohio history. And then he went on to the U.S. Senate. In 2004, he was reelected to the U.S. Senate in a record turnout year, but by more than nobody ever got more votes than George Voinovich did in his reelection to the Senate in 2004, 3.5 million votes.
Yeah.
So, you know, he had critics, but he had a lot of people who supported him, who liked what he did, who felt that he was doing the right things at the right time. You keep hearing tributes to him claiming that he's bipartisan and moderate and a centrist. And these are really interesting terms as you look toward the Republican convention. You know, would Cleveland have even had a shot at the Republican convention if it hadn't been for what George Voinovich did in Cleveland?
Yes, that's
right. And then you've got people coming into this convention, including Donald Trump, who some folks say George Voinovich really would not have supported. And in fact, Voinovich never took a stand on Trump, but seemed to be leaning in the direction of not endorsing him.
Donald Trump was certainly not George Voinovich's kind of politician. And you mentioned 1994.
Yeah.
And that race was unbelievable because there were any number of high-profile Democrats who could have run against him in that race, but they ran when they saw his approval rate.
They didn't run the race. They ran the other way.
They just ran away. They, you know, they said, we're not gonna have any part of this. And the only guy they could find was a little-known state senator from eastern Ohio named Rob Burch, who was very smart, very personable, good guy. But, you know, he had absolutely no chance in the world against George Voinovich. And Voinovich's popularity was very high. And it wasn't a charismatic type popularity. I think it was an admiration by people for, you know, the way he conducted himself in office and his administrative skills.
And consider that in 1994, he was running not too long after the deadly riot at Lucasville.
Oh,
I mean, this
yeah.
was an 11-day
right.
riot
yes.
where a guard and inmates were killed, and his approval ratings were very good even after that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he was elected by the largest margin, the largest percentage in 1994. 7 out of 10 people voted for him, and this was after the riot.
Yes.
So
mm-hmm.
and this was after he'd also increased taxes, which is something right. that a lot of Republicans would not consider at this moment.
James, how do you remember Voinovich?
Well, they talked about his popularity, and what I remember, you know, I came when he was in the Senate. I came to Ohio in 2000, and he was already in the Senate. But what I, in my several interviews with him and covering issues that he was passionate about, what I discovered that what people were attracted to him is that he did what he said he was going to do. And that he was the rarest of rare breeds, which is a principled politician. And by that, I mean, there were times, like in 2002, 2003, I can't remember the exact year, where he took on George Bush. He took on his own party because mm-hmm. they wanted to do the Education Spending Act, and it would have added another $1 billion to the deficit. And as we all know, George Voinovich was a deficit hawk. So, I mean, Bush even came to the state and was like, he had speeches in Dayton and he had speeches in Columbus to try to put pressure on Voinovich and his cadre in the Senate, to get them to change their minds, and they didn't give in, and eventually the White House had to cut some stuff out of that bill,
yeah.
and they actually caved because Voinovich stood his ground. But as much as he was a deficit hawk, he understood that government, even as a Republican, he understood government had a role, and he wanted it to work. And one of the big things he believed in was transportation, and he saw. Way back when, and he was known for this as governor, and even in Cleveland, that the need for transportation equals jobs, equal jobs in his mind, and that they weren't just Pork Barrel projects. They actually worked in terms of economic development and keeping goods and services and people moving. And so he might rail against overspending, but when it came to transportation, I remember going to Washington to cover an event, and they had briefed him on the Brent Spence Bridge, and the very next day he shows up with a big, big, huge life-size picture of the bridge and says, we need to fix this now, at a committee meeting. I mean, he was passionate. He was probably the leading advocate before his retirement in the Senate for the Brent Spence Bridge project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there was no backing down with this guy. I mean, you could pressure him and you could put in all the the leadership in the Senate tried it. The President of the United States tried it. He wouldn't back down if he thought he was right.
Karen, how would you characterize Voinovich's knowledge of government?
Well, he was elected official for 43 years. Served at local, state, and federal levels. And I've talked to some people who said that Mike Curtin, the former reporter and editor for the Dispatch, who's now in the state House of Representatives, as a Democrat, mind you, said that in covering him in his newspaper career of more than 40 years, he never met anybody who had such a depth of knowledge of government as George Voinovich did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of his background. Go ahead.
Go ahead, James.
No, and I think it was his true desire to want it to work. He wanted government to work. Now, the scale of government was what the debate was about, and where you compromise here and there. But he saw a role for government in people's lives, and whether like I said, the flashpoints came over how much you should spend and how much you should tax. But again, he truly believed that in the role of government, unlike the debate that's going on right now, mm-hmm. which is a lot of times you'll see just burn the whole thing down. He truly believed in it.
Yeah. So I think that's and you know, this whole idea of bipartisanship. At the funeral this morning, Ted Strickland was there. Cleveland Mayor Frank Jackson was there. Dennis Kucinich, who Voinovich beat in 1979, was there, along with other Republicans who were there. That speaks to the impact that he had on people across the aisle. And I've heard a lot of stories about how he did try to work with people across the aisle, that he really he bucked his own party on certain things, advocating for an increase in the gas tax, for instance, going back to the whole discussion about the importance of transportation and infrastructure. You know, he really believed in certain things and wanted to enact them. And you know, he had causes that he cared about, kids and education. He was very dedicated to his Catholic faith, to his family. Yes. He got emotional at times. Yes. I'm sure Howard can remember some stories about him getting very emotional about certain circumstances. So, you know, he was quite an interesting person.
Yeah. I remember him shedding tears, actually, when he and this was his idea, that he was ending welfare payments to single able-bodied adults. And it affected him, but he said it had to be done. He wasn't going to do it to, aided dependent children, but he ended the welfare payments to single able-bodied adults. And when he was asked about it, he actually had tears in his eyes and said, "Look, I care about people. I mean, this affects me."
I pulled that tape for our TV show, The State of Ohio. Bill Cohen, my colleague here at the State House, meticulous archives, and he had that one. It really, you hear Voinovich's voice break, saying, "I'm doing the best I can with what I've got." And you know, I think he did get a lot of criticism for those cuts, but I think he felt that pretty deeply. From what I understand, he really wasn't a politician that put on tears. They were really genuine.
Yeah. It was. I mean, he was a very emotional guy. I mean, he really was. And his emotions were very close to the surface sometimes, whether they were good or bad.
Hey, James?
Well, and on the flip side, like you said, he wears his heart on his sleeve. I don't think I've ever seen a politician encapsulate where he's from more than Voinovich. I really felt like, obviously he became a statewide elected official, governor in the Senate and so forth. And I never saw a bigger cheerleader for Ohio and standing up for the interests of Ohio. And he was inserted into national politics. But I think probably if you would poll people who have been around for 20, 30 years, he's probably still got to be up there as one of the most popular, if the most popular governor the state's ever had. But he was also a great salesman for the state. He just loved Cleveland. He loved the city. He loved the state.
Yeah, particularly Cleveland. I mean, his attachment to Cleveland was unbelievable. I mean, he grew up there, obviously, in Collinwood, to Serbian, Slovenian parents. He and his wife Janet, they lived in the same house from the time they got married till now. And it was an interesting thing about him. He was, he was known as kind of a tightwad, a penny pincher, and he never
frugal.
Thank you, Karen.
Right. Exactly, frugal. And he never put air conditioning in that house because he said it was a waste of money. He said you can open the windows and you can turn on fans. Why am I going to spend money on, and that was the kind of guy he was. You could see that come out in his personal life, and then you'd see it reflected in his public life.
Well, how are you saying it? Go ahead, Karen.
I just want to add one thing. The whole idea of popularity. The Ohio poll that was done, we haven't seen one for a long time, but out of the University of Cincinnati, the Ohio poll polled Voinovich's job approval ratings 22 times while he was governor, and in 14 of those 22 polls, his approval rating was over 60%.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive in terms of popularity. And I think any politician would give a lot to be over 60% just once in a while, much
right.
less.
Being able to keep it that long is amazing.
Yeah.
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 Hey, Howard, were his ties to Cleveland, the fact that it was his hometown, is that why you were saying being Cleveland mayor was his favorite of all the jobs he ever did?
Well, yeah, it was. I mean, that was his home, and that was where he raised his family, and that's, was very important to him. And he saw that city was failing, and failing badly, and he was very proud of the fact that he was able to go there and work across the aisle with people like George Forbes, a Democrat who was the president of city council at the time, and save that city. And to him, that was the ultimate experience of his career.
And it's no accident that he was lying in repose in Cleveland City Hall this week,
yep.
and that his funeral mass was this morning on the east side of Cleveland. You know, he could have been here at the State House, where we've had, right. you know, Governor Rhodes was here, and various other public officials have lain here. And it was Voinovich's decision and his family's decision to have him in Cleveland. There's a reason for that.
That's right. Exactly.
Now, let's move on to some other Ohio news, and it's still in the area of politics. Now we have the Democratic and Republican presumptive nominees, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump. Now, how much are their campaigns starting to kick into gear in Ohio? What are we starting to see?
Well, I think it's interesting that we saw Hillary Clinton making her first speech as the presumptive Democratic nominee in Cleveland.
Yeah.
I think she intended to give a different kind of speech than she did give because, you know, coming off the tragedy in Orlando, I think that kind of shifted her focus a little bit more from sheerly politics to something a little bit more related to some of the other issues that she's working on, including gun
right.
control legislation. So, but I think she, you know, she went after Donald Trump then, and I think though not by name, and I think it just sets the stage for what we're going to see this fall.
It'll be interesting to see. I guess next Tuesday, she's supposed to do a campaign event in Columbus, and I think the tone of that one will be much different than the one in Cleveland that was, you know, as Karen said, right after the tragedy in Orlando.
And to that point, she already had scheduled to she had scheduled to stop in Cincinnati, and she rescheduled it twice and finally wound up canceling it because of the Orlando situation. But I would imagine we would start to see both candidates, not necessarily in Cincinnati, but certainly in the state on a weekly basis.
Oh, yeah.
And in
absolutely.
Cincinnati.
Yeah.
I bet you.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I would count. It probably would take both hands to count the number of times both candidates combined will make stops in Cincinnati.
Yeah, that's a given. I mean, this is a key swing state. This is a bellwether state. This is a very important place.
And not only that, but
you've got to win.
Cincinnati is seen as a major, major fundraising center, especially for the Republicans, but not
too.
So much anymore. I mean, last two elections, Hamilton County went blue, which is the first time that's happened forever.
Right.
But you know, they're traditionally the Republicans will come into Indian Hill and have a fundraiser, but more and more we're seeing the Democrats do the same thing.
Yes.
Have we gotten any word on Donald Trump visits yet?
No, not yet. I mean, there's been nothing scheduled that I've seen.
I read in Politico, actually, that Trump is a bit short on funds and organization to the point where he's actually having to go to the well in some Republican stronghold states rather than coming to the swing states.
And that's true. That's absolutely right.
That Clinton has advantage in that way.
Yeah,
it's funny. It came up that I'm at a reporting seminar in New Orleans right now, and one of the sessions today was on dark money and campaign financing and things. And there's a lot of attention being paid to how the usual major power brokers like the Koch brothers are going to play this because they supported everybody but Trump in the primaries, and their people are meeting. And they're pumping a ton of money into down-ticket races, both local and statewide, but they have not yet entered the fray in the presidential campaign. And Trump has been talking a lot about how he's self-financed and he's not beholden to anybody. But as Bob said, they're out of money. I mean, he doesn't have the kind of money that usually a Republican candidate has because of all the PACs and so forth. So it's going to be interesting to see how he plays along with the Republican establishment now that he needs them as much as they need him.
And Karen, go ahead.
He's not going to get that money.
Let's get Karen in here.
Well, I was just going to say, I think you have that relationship of people, they need Trump, Trump needs them. For instance, social conservatives. There are a group of social conservatives who are going to New York to meet with him on Tuesday, pro-life leaders and that sort of thing. Ohio Right to Life is going to be meeting with him. You know, it's an interesting group because these voters wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton, but they say that Donald Trump needs them, but they need him. And so it'll be interesting to see if that base of the party can bring in some of the money that he needs when, as I just heard, you know, the Koch brothers are kind of bowing out of a lot of this. And we've got a lot of money that's going to be focused on those down ticket races, especially the Rob Portman and the Ted Strickland Senate race. Exactly.
Well, and Karen, it's interesting, too. You have two candidates who have high unfavorable ratings. The ABC News Washington Post poll, the most recent one, showed 70% unfavorable for Trump and 55% for Hillary Clinton.
Well, you have the second most unpopular presidential candidate in history running against the most unpopular candidate in history. So it's quite a choice.
You would think that that could potentially turn off voters and make
but it
voter
won't.
Turnout. No, it won't. In
it
fact,
won't.
There are people who are suggesting it could be record turnout this time because of the passions involved here.
Yeah.
Well, meantime, we have the Republican National Convention coming up next month, July 18th through the 21st in Cleveland. So, Karen, how's Cleveland doing in its preparations for this?
Well, they've got the keys of the Quicken Loans Arena now.
Yeah, they cleaned out Quicken Loans Arena. I was actually at the Cavs game last night.
So they
finally ended the Cavs season there. The last game will be in California on Sunday, and hopefully Cavs will win, but that's just my personal bias right there.
I'm jealous you were there, Karen. So.
It was insane, I've got to say. I've never seen an NBA game, and it was just unbelievable. But now it's time to clean it out and get it ready for the convention. They've got 4 weeks to get it ready. And, that's not a lot of time when you consider how many people are going to be there and what you've got to deal with in terms of the security, in terms of the production, in terms of all the things that are going to have to happen. I mean, as of this moment, I don't think I know where I'm staying hotel room wise. I think the convention is still working out some of those things with media housing and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, good. It's not just me then.
No.
But there are a lot of questions here that have to be answered in the next 4 weeks before this convention starts. And you know, this is a big thing. A lot of attention is going to be on Cleveland, not just because of Donald Trump, but because of the whole party in general and what could happen here. These next 4 weeks are going to be critical for Cleveland and for the Republicans to nail everything down and get it ready for that national exposure.
Well, and then you had Governor Kasich saying this week that safety is going to be a huge concern for the RNC, especially in light of the mass shooting in Orlando. Did the governor say anything about what he has in mind for increasing security?
I think, you know, the questions about that, I think he's trying to leave some of that up to local officials, but also if need be, bringing, you know, state money and resources into it. I mean, Cleveland's going to be bringing in a lot of outside resources, manpower, so to speak, to get ready for this. But, you know, there is always that question. I mean, there are always protesters. There are always people who will come with opposing views. The question is, this time, are they going to come with opposing views and be violent about them?
Yeah.
And we have some breaking political news today, and that concerns Governor Kasich actually vetoing Senate Bill 296. So, Karen and Howard, can you fill us in on what's going on with this?
You want to take it, Howard, or do you want me to?
Go ahead,
Karen.
Okay, this is the bill from State Senator Bill Seitz of Cincinnati. This one tried to crack down on last-minute court orders that keep polling places open on Election Day, and he basically set up a situation where if you want a court order, you have to post a cash bond that would cover the cost of keeping the polls open, and to try to make some rules on what judges could do, and this would only affect state court judges, not federal court judges.
And federal court judges are the ones that generally do this.
Yes, that's right. Because the one that Senator Seitz was especially upset about
was Susan Delott, a U.S. District Court judge, and it wouldn't have applied to her.
Right, and I think Senator Seitz's point was to try to draw attention to this and maybe federal judges would pay attention, but the governor vetoed it, and it was interesting because we kind of saw this one coming because he was very, he didn't speak out against it, but he didn't. There were signs, let's just put it that way. This is only the second veto that he's issued on a full bill. And he said that the not giving the judges the ability to waive that and not giving judges that freedom that really bothered him. And so he vetoed it.
Yeah, he never really embraced this at all. This was obviously something that Bill Seitz pushed through the legislature. And I didn't believe Kasich was going to have any part of it.
Yeah. This was, I mean, Seitz had said that this was about cutting down on frivolous lawsuits.
Right.
But there were people who said if you require a cash bond to be posted, then that could potentially disenfranchise people who really do need the polls to stay open
right.
because of a serious circumstance.
Well, some people, I mean, you know, like Cecil Thomas, state senator, was calling it a poll tax.
Yes. And he wasn't the only one. There were several right. others who were referring to it that as well. So,
sure.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Karen, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Glad to be here anytime.
Yeah. Ohio Thanks. Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. And we will continue our review of the news. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and joining me this afternoon are WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Education Reporter Bob Driehaus, Investigative Reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer James Pilcher, and WVXU Political Reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, Bob, got word this week, Santa Ono is leaving UC. He's going to take the top job at the University of British Columbia. That's going to be his, sort of a homecoming for,
yeah.
for him, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. He was born there in 1954 when his dad was a professor at that university. So he wrote a pretty heartfelt letter to the community talking about his love and affection for UC, but also this pull to have a homecoming of sorts. And not just that he was born there, but also it's the place that welcomed in his immigrant family. His parents came from Japan.
So what's been his impact, would you say, since he started with UC back in 2012?
Yeah, he assumed the presidency in 2012, and it was a heck of a 4 years, really. The thing that people keep going back to is how he raised the profile of the university. He was just aggressive on social media, especially Twitter. He replied to incoming students and folks from all over the country. He had over 70,000 Twitter followers, and it really did have an impact just on the way people felt about the pride they took in UC. And there were real solid numbers too behind that too. Record enrollment as he leaves at a time when other universities around the region have enrollment going down.
He was a prodigious fundraiser, too, in terms of...
Definitely. Their endowment was about $1 billion when he came, and it's $200 million
yeah.
more than that now.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he had a lot of fans out there, some with deep pockets.
What about the... I mean, I remember when he came, and he talked about this as a 10-year commitment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, it didn't turn out that way.
Yeah, he had a 10-year contract, actually.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
What does he say about that in terms of this move?
I haven't talked to him personally yet. I hope yeah. I can. He said in that letter to the community that there were just a handful of places that would have even tempted him, and this was one.
Mm-hmm.
And the opportunity came, and he took it.
Yeah.
Bob, any idea of if the shooting of Sam DeBose, the Ray Tenzin case, if that had any influence on his decision?
You know, a lot of people are speculating about that. I can certainly not say anything definitive, but, you know, the Officer Tensing's case is coming up, and there's going to be a lot of background released on what led to the shooting of Samuel DeBose. And there were administrative decisions where he was in charge ultimately that gave the green light for UC police to do more aggressive patrolling in the neighborhood surrounding
yeah.
the university. And so there may be some perceived culpability there, and some argue that his stock was peaking in terms of his ability to move on to other universities. Although, again, he certainly didn't bring it up, and I don't have anything to substantiate that.
Yeah, James, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that you know, there are still a lot of unanswered questions about how the police was operating and who basically gave, to quote from the famous movie, who gave the code red to allow the police to act in the way they were in their policing practices and the aggressive traffic stops around and even off campus. We've been trying at the Enquirer to dig into that quite a bit. And, where did the buck stop?
Yeah.
And so those questions are all going to still be out there as the trial comes up, I think in October. Obviously the UC's made a ton of moves in terms of trying to fix the police department. They hired two veteran UC officers and captains to run it. And I think they're, backed off on some of their policies, but there's still that tension between the city and at one point, Mayor Cranley said they shouldn't even have a police force at UC, so that's still a little bit of a sticking point. What's going to be interesting, too, is how UC goes about finding the replacement. My colleague Jason Williams had a great piece today in his weekly political column pointing out that the chairman of the board of regents is also in charge of the UC search, is also a potential mayoral candidate. Rob Richardson Jr., his name's been thrown around quite a bit as possibly going up against Yvette Simpson and John Cranley, is considering a run, but at the same time, he's going to be front and center in finding the replacement in this one of the highest profile positions in the entire region or city. So, that puts him squarely in the spotlight. So there's a lot of questions, and there's questions about how they're going to do the search. Are they going to do it in an open, transparent way? There were questions raised about how they actually did it when they got sent to Ono. They had these mysterious drop boxes where the resumes would come in and nobody would see them. And, the skullduggery that sometimes goes on in these kinds of searches is going to be interesting to see what they're able to do.
And Bob, how much do we know at this point about how UC plans to go about searching for his replacement?
Yeah, they have committed to a nationwide search. They're going to have a committee of a cross-section of the community with board representation. You'll see faculty on there and other stakeholders too. How transparent it will be, I guess that remains to be seen.
Yeah. How tough is it going to be to find his replacement? I mean, he's you're noting great fundraiser, immensely popular, prominent on social media. How tough a job is this going to be for them?
Well, I think if I were UC, I'd be pitching it as you're going to be standing on the shoulders of past success, enrollment is still trending in the right direction. Money is flowing in with the endowments. There are a lot of things going right for the university. So I would imagine you're going to have some pretty qualified folks looking to take over. And although she hasn't said yet, the provost, interim president, Beverly Davenport, I would be surprised if she didn't put her own hat in the ring.
Okay. And the thing that will obviously attract more candidates is they're on the cusp of possibly joining the Big 12, one of the largest, probably the second most important athletic conference in the country behind the SEC. So they're poised to jump into the big boy leagues of Division I, both football and basketball. So, whoever comes in, Ono set the table, but they could take credit for it. They could stand on the podium at the press conference and say, hey, look, we got into the Big 12. So that's a potential plum for somebody out there as well.
I should add, too, when we're talking about standing on shoulders, there were some folks in senior administration who chafed a little bit at the idea that, the sun rose and fell on President Ono, that as well as he did, there were some folks who laid a lot of groundwork that he got to take advantage of. Some credit went to Nancy Zimpfer for the enrollment surge and a lot of pride in a very large community of people.
Well,
working
he seemed like
schools.
He was just omnipresent. I mean, in the
well, it was the tweeting.
I mean, he was a one man band at the Reds ballpark.
And he was, always tweeting, Howard. So that's that was part of that whole.
Some people saw that as I will say that the people I've talked to, some people were a little put off by that as much as he did it.
Right.
I mean, they understood it, but it became a little self-promotional. And then there was some of us in the transparency, investigative, reporting and all that crowd who felt it was a little disingenuous and possibly hypocritical because he was so open and honest with everybody that when we would ask him hard questions, he wouldn't comment.
Yeah.
So it was like, especially about the police stuff and whatever. And so that was and it was he couldn't be reached if we had hard questions. So there were those, you know, little conflicts.
Bob, has UC said anything about when they want to get his replacement in place?
Yeah, I asked their spokesman yesterday. This all happened very quickly, so the board has not convened to get that going. He said he's available to stay until mid-July, I'm sure they'll get it kicking as quickly as possible, but they do have a very veteran administrator leading the university in the meantime in Beverly Davenport. So I'm sure they'll take their time to make sure they get it right.
And in the meantime, Cincinnati State just named its new president this week, Monica Posey, who's been serving as the interim since Odell Owens left. So tell us about her.
Yeah. So Dr. Posey is a veteran of Cincinnati State. A lot of firsts with her being named the permanent president. She is the first African-American woman to lead any of the higher ed institutions in Greater Cincinnati, as far as Cincinnati State knows and as far as I know. She is also the first internal candidate to be promoted to the presidency at Cincinnati State since its mission expanded in 1994. She's also the first one with a black belt.
A black belt?
Yes, indeed.
In which martial art?
Karate.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, don't mess with her.
That's right. Yeah.
Made for an interesting board meeting.
Yeah, it sure will.
Yeah.
What has she said so far about her goals for Cincinnati State and the direction she plans to take it in?
Yeah. So, she doesn't want to tear up their old mission. What she wants is to really start to thrive in areas of finding training folks for all those high-skilled labor positions that we hear about, high-skilled manufacturing that are going unfilled and such. She wants to raise the college's profile locally and around the country so that people know this is a place to go without spending a lot of money, or in most cases, a lot of time, to go find yourself in a really positive career.
Well, I know that when Odell left, when Dr. Owens left, there was this conflict between him and the board over, you know, the president's role in terms of fundraising and the like, and trying to go out and get more private dollars endowed for Cincinnati State. So I know that that's going to be something that's going to be watched as she takes over as well, because that was a flashpoint in the last administration.
Yeah, their endowment is shockingly low, shocking to me anyway. I just mentioned UC's is $1.2 billion. Cincinnati State's is $5 million, and that's after they just got a $2 million estate grant estate gift last year. So they've got a lot of work to do in that regard. They have Elliot Ruther working for them in development now, one of Mayor Cranley's old right-hand guys.
Yeah. We will continue our review of the news, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. It's our weekly review of news affecting the tri-state area. And joining me this afternoon, WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Education Reporter Bob Driehaus, Investigative Reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer James Pilcher, and WVXU Political Reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, James, was it last October, Mayor Cranley orders an audit of the Cincinnati Board of Park Commissioners, and that was after the Enquirer had some stories that were disclosing irregular spending by park board officials. Was last year, right, that whole thing started?
Yeah, it was right. Yeah. It was actually about 2 weeks before the election or so, when we did our first round of reporting on how they were using these private endowments for bonuses and car allowances and things like that.
They got an update this week, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe not an update.
So I sat down with City Manager Harry Black just to kind of get a sense for the time frame, because they just cleared the decks with the they don't call it an audit, but they call it an internal review of MSD, because my colleagues Dan Horn and Sherry Coolidge did such a great job of exposing the problems there. They did their own internal review of MSD, and that came out about 2 weeks ago. And actually, they've referred it to the Ethics Commission and possibly the prosecutor. But Joe Dieters has said, hey, I'm waiting to see if the feds do anything, and basically confirming we've already reported that the FBI is looking into this. So I sat down with City Manager Black, and basically he told me that he's hoping to get it wrapped up by the end of the month, but you know it might run into a little bit of next month, which creates an issue for council members because they're being asked to vote on a budget that includes $4 million, $4 million more for the Parks Board to handle some of their deferred maintenance. But they can always go back and change the budget if they find something. But this is different. This one is not an internal review. They hired an outside firm from Indianapolis for about $45,000. And they're in the process of, you know, going through all the documents. But this is just phase one of what could be a deeper investigation if they find stuff. So they're just basically mapping out how all the money flowed between the private nonprofit Parks Foundation, which was created in the 90s, as well as the Park Board with the public money coming in from the city budget, as well as the parks endowments, which were basically funds that were bequeathed to the Park Board in as many as 70, 80 years ago by private individuals. So there's all these different pots of money, and how do they flow, and is it possible?
And that's all the level. This is all the level one, phase one stuff that you're talking about.
Yeah, so they're going to map out how all that money flowed, and should it have flown a certain way? Did it go the right way? You know, some of the stuff we've explored in some of our previous coverage with my colleague Carrie Blackmore Smith. The interesting thing too, as opposed to like the MSD. Both City Manager Black and Mayor Cranley can say, hey, we inherited this. You know, we found out this was bad. We started looking into it. Obviously the Inquirer looked into it and all of that. But they have some, the political distance from this. What's going to be interesting about the Parks situation is that, Willie Cardin and Otto Budig, Otto Budig is the chairman of the board, and Willie Cardin has long time been the executive director of the
board. And by the way, I should mention, too, he's a member of the Cincinnati Public Radio Board. So
okay. Otto is, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
They're still in their jobs. Willie is obviously well-beloved by a lot of people. Council basically gave him a vote of confidence after some of our stories ran out. And at one point, pretty soon after he got elected initially, Mayor Cranley nominated him to be city manager. So there's possible political blowback on this, depending on what they find, what they do. I don't even know if they're going to get into the kind of spending that we had found through our records requests on trips and dining and even $300 pair of headphones at one point. It's going to be interesting. In terms of how far does the timing of it, how far does it go? In terms of what is it disclosed? Obviously, the other big shoe to drop a couple months ago was that a lot of this work done on Smale using public money, much less the private money, was done using these no bid master service agreements. They were already in place, so they just shelved the money. They saw all these firms around the town, never got a chance to bid on it, and it was just. And they've been doing that for a long time, much less, not what they said they were doing it, which was to get it done in time for the All-Star game.
No, and I think the Park Board would say, in terms of that, they would say, we've been effective, though. Measure us by our effectiveness and how well all these things have turned out.
Yeah, but that's a slippery slope argument for a lot of people because it does the ends justify the means. We're talking about possibly breaking city laws, maybe possibly... violating ethics ordinances and things like that.
None of that's happened. I mean, nobody's charged in this or
no,
nobody's
no,
okay.
Nobody, no, no, that's what I'm saying. But those questions are still out there in terms of that's what we're waiting for the audit to find. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
I wanted to go back to the MSD investigation, James, and get your take on this. It seems like this is something that's going to take a long time to sort through all the information and all the details they're pulling out. Where do you think this is headed? How long do you think it's going to take to flesh this out?
Well, it depends on what the outcome is. I mean, it what complicates it, is that it's this dual partnership, which is obviously very, very strained between Hamilton County and the city. Hamilton County owns MSD for the most part. There are some assets within MSD that the city owns, some buildings, some of the plants, and so forth. But in terms of an entity, the county owns MSD, but the city runs it. It's like a city department. But they have been getting influx of federal and tons of federal money because they're under a consent decree to upgrade the system because it's so far under environmental standards. So basically they've been given a blank check to try to fix it as fast as they can, and we're talking hundreds of millions or billions of dollars over the last 10, 15 years. Well, over that time, you had city employees running this with very little oversight and given carte blanche by previous city managers. So untangling all that, and at one point, Dan and Sherry did a story showing that, the ratepayers' money that was going into this was helping pay for parks projects in the city, even if that rate money came from outside the city. So it entangles so many different departments. It's going to take
a while to unwind this. Yeah.
Right. And then now there's calls from Hamilton County to completely dissolve the partnership and each entity go their separate ways, which would take even longer because of the complicated nature of this.
Howard, what do you think the political blowback from this might be?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to say at this point. Like James says, I mean, we're just starting to scratch the surface on this. We don't know how deep this goes and how far it goes and who it points to. There have been questions raised, about contracts going to individuals and city officials putting pressure on a law firm to pay these individuals. I mean, it depends. I mean, it's far too early to say, but there's potential for big political blowback here.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm Yvette Simpson or Mr. Richardson, and it comes out that Parks was run improperly,
right?
Or even that Parks had an improper relationship with MSD. At that point, you can't just say, there are two major high profile departments under your watch.
Right. Then it becomes a political issue, period.
And here the head of one of them was going to be your city manager.
Right.
Now, if I'm sitting there and I'm a candidate running against you, I'm going to use that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it certainly will be.
Real quick, I wanted to touch on the Cincinnati Gardens, too, because I'm really sentimental about this. I've saw the Royals play there when I was a kid. And,
yeah, me too.
I watched many a Xavier game there, and I even went to a few hockey games. So for a long time, it's been the place for sports and concerts in Cincinnati. So now I understand the Port Authority, Port of Greater Cincinnati Development Authority, is going to be the new owner of this property. And what are they planning to do with that, Howard?
Tear it down.
Oh, wow.
And redevelop the property. There's 20 acres out there, and it's going to be something else. It's going away, and the reason it's going away is there's not much use for it anymore. Unfortunately, I mean, there are other venues for concerts, for athletic teams. Xavier obviously doesn't need it anymore.
Yeah, I think it's sort of orphaned in an area.
It is. It's orphaned in an area. Yeah,
not a lot of population and
not a lot of people.
And the Port Authority sees a lot of upside in that land around the gardens, that 20 acres around the
gardens.
They
believe that they can bring development there that will create jobs and do something to help that community. Mm-hmm. And right now, Cincinnati Gardens is not helping that community.
James, can you make it quick, James?
My favorite gardens story is that the Royals back in the 60s were always playing against the Celtics, and they were up against the Celtics, but the Gardens had booked the circus. So that the home team, the home games for the Royals were at the Armory. They wound up losing and going seven games against the Celtics. They would have probably gone on to win the NBA championship that year.
This is from a Celtics fan.
Yep. Thanks, everybody, for joining me today. WCPO.com, WCPO Insider Education Reporter Bob Driehaus, Investigative Reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer James Pilcher, and WVXU Political Reporter Howard Wilkinson.